Hello and welcome to The Scoop, a provincial newscast and podcast with stories from LJI journalists around British Columbia. Each week, reporters from Revelstoke, Cortez Island, Kootenay, Terrace, Prince George, and Smithers will share the news affecting their place in BC. I'm your host and producer, Pamela Hassan, from CSCK News in Smithers. The Scoop was made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada and the Local Journalism Initiative Program, or LJI. Follow The Scoop on CICK, Smithers Community Radio, 93.9 FM, every Thursday and Saturday at noon, online at smithersradio.com, and of course, wherever you get your podcasts. The Lataco Quesnel 2024 BC Winter Games are coming to the region this February 22nd to 25th. Ian Gregg has the scoop. This unseasonable and, let's face it, downright weird weather didn't stop the Rosalind Winter Carnival this year, merely delayed it. CJLY's Scott Onyshek joined the huddled masses. The roof has structural damage. Cortez Island's Free Store is raising money for their volunteer-built Free Store's much-needed new roof. Why do Free Stores matter? Listen to CKTZ's Lonnie Taylor's Roof Scoop. North America's longest-running citizen science project, the Christmas Bird Count, continues in its 124th year. Community reporter Christine Bruce has the swoop. I mean scoop. Another LNG pipeline proposal docks at the Prince Rupert Port Authority. CFNR's Sabrina Spencer is talking to Trigon CEO Rob Booker for this week's scoop.
In Dawalawan, I'm Sabrina Spencer with The Journey Continues, highlighting local stories that matter to you. Trigon Pacific Terminals Limited has completed the project description for its proposed Trigon Pacific LPG project and submitted it to the Prince Rupert Port Authority. CEO Rob Booker spoke with CFNR about the project and the benefits that a project like this would bring to the Prince Rupert Port Authority and to Prince Rupert itself. I can get your name and position.
Rob Booker, CEO of Trigon Pacific Terminals, located in Prince Rupert, BC.
Trigon recently proposed LPG project to the Prince Rupert Port Authority, and that was on Wednesday.
We actually initially asked for an increase in our permitted products this fall from the Port Authority, and then as a follow-up to that ask, we submitted a project description last Wednesday. That's correct.
Can you tell me a bit about the bit of the description about this project specifically?
The project is based on meeting growing demand for LPG exports. So there's an increase of liquid propane gas being produced in Western Canada, and there's a significant increase in demand in Asia, and demand from Canada in particular is a secure source of supply. Our project is based on our site, so on the existing terminal site, all brownfield, so we're not building any new docks, no increase in rail capacity on our site. We'll use existing track. We might have to add a little bit of track. And then we'll use the existing brownfield site because we're having vacant land as a result of the loss of thermal coal. So thermal coal is being stopped for export from Canada. And as that occurs, our volumes are decreasing and we have land area available to handle other commodities.
So what does this mean for the Prince Rupert Port Authority and Prince Rupert itself?
Well, for Trigon and our employees, what it means is that we're able to diversify and we're able to continue to keep people employed, you know, provide great service to Western Canada as an export outlet for liquid propane gas.
If the Prince Rupert Port Authority does not approve or agree, or what would that mean? What are the downsides of not having this project in Rupert?
Well, we're very confident in our legal position, and you know we're very confident that ultimately we'll be allowed to ship LPG. You know, in the negative, we're going to lose several million tons of thermal coal over the next few years, and if we don't have a product to replace that with, it's going to be very difficult for us.
The press release that I have, it says that it's privately owned with equity positions held by the Lachlan's and Metlakatla?
Yes. The terminal was privatized in 2019. It was formerly held by the Government of Canada. And the owners are AMCI, which operate the Conuma coal mines in Northeast BC, Riverstone, which is based in New York and is an investment organization, as well as the Metlakatla and Lac La Lam all took a stake in the company.
Is there anything else that you'd like to share or add at all?
We're really excited at this step. It's, you know, a critical step in advancing the project. And we'll, you know, be advancing engineering, qualitative risk assessments, environmental impacts. All of those steps will be advancing as in the normal course of a project. And we're really excited about the future when it goes ahead.
CFNR did reach out to the Prince Rupert Port Authority for comment on the Trigon Pacific Terminals Limited proposal, and they replied to CFNR via email saying the Prince Rupert Port Authority can confirm that Trigon Pacific Terminals has submitted a project description to us. Prince Rupert Port Authority is mandated through the Canadian Marine Act to manage the Federal Crown and line with its defined jurisdiction, including all properties on Ridley Island, and has the responsibility to provide consent for specific categories being moved through or stored on any of its properties. Prince Rupert Port Authority has not given Trigon consent to expand its permitted use beyond its current portfolio outlined in its lease with the Prince Rupert Port Authority. This story is brought to you in partnership with the Local Journalism Initiative of Canada. You can see the full story at frequencynews.ca.
In other news, the waste a community creates has to go somewhere. But landfills just aren't a viable option anymore for the amount of garbage we humans create. The Cortez Island Free Store is one place where, quote, garbage, unquote, is given a second chance. But the volunteer-built structure is in desperate need of a facelift. Here's CKTZ's Lonnie Taylor on that.
This is a CKTZ News Update. I'm Lonnie Taylor. The Free Store has initiated a GoFundMe account to raise $6,000 for a new roof, which is in emergency need of repair. According to the GoFundMe webpage, the roof is leaking and urgently needs replacing before more structural damage occurs. The cost to replace the existing roof is just shy of $6,000. The webpage goes on to say, quote, "Let's keep this invaluable community resource viable and dry. Free store strong," end quote. The damage was discovered in December when the Free Store initiated the GoFundMe account by volunteers of the Free Store. And I spoke with one volunteer, Lorianne Panton, to find out more about this endeavor and how the Free Store works. Lorianne replied by email and said, quote, "The Free Store is an autonomous entity that exists because of community volunteers and generosity. I did reach out to a couple of nonprofits on the island, but as we have nearly reached our fundraising goal for the roof, we'll not be pursuing those relationships at this time," end quote. I also spoke with Regional Director Mark Vinesh to find out if it was possible for the Free Store to receive any funding from the Regional District or the Comox Valley Strathcona Regional District Waste Management Department, and this is what he had to say.
Yeah, Free Store, one of the jewels of Cortez. Such an amazing place, important for climate change, important for young families. It's such a great place to reduce and reuse our waste. I put a motion forward through the Comox Strathcona Waste Management Board for us to explore across the whole Comox and Strathcona districts, how can we expand and grow the Free Stores on Free Store type places in these areas. So that's a report that's going to be coming back this year on ways that we can grow it. Right now, the Free Store is like a free entity run by volunteers at the Waste Management Center. So it's a punk style system. It doesn't get any support from anyone. It's not its own society. It just happens on the desk on the side of the property there. And I think there's opportunities to make it more official. But unless it's a nonprofit society, for example, we can't put grant and aid funding there. So I think it's something that I know the community loves and cares about, and I'm definitely taking action on how we can like sustain and grow Free Stores across the district, including Cortez. But there's nothing, as far as I know, that where there's ways for us to directly support it. But I do hope that people to donate to the GoFundMe at this stage, and it's definitely on my eye and something that I obviously care about and want to see happen. But for the Free Store and for these things, part of my job is to be in the position of looking across the whole district. So yes, I'm representing Cortez, but when I'm sitting at the board level, I'm thinking like district wide and trying to work with other board members to make decisions that are good for Cortez, but good for the whole, our common districts. And it's a huge waste management. It's a boring thing, but the opportunities there, both socially, like these free stores, and economically and environmentally, are actually huge. So I've went into initially being like, okay, waste management. But now that I've gone into it, it's actually exciting. You can make a real difference, and a real difference to people economically and the environmental impacts, because we're just all the garbage in Cortez goes into these big trucks, gets shipped to Comox, put in a landfill, right? We've got to figure out ways to decrease that. The goal of the waste management board has to be to, like, let's move more and more to working ourselves out of a job. I don't think that's necessarily ever going to happen, but decreasing the waste that's going into landfills is, you know, it's an easy, there's a lot of low hanging fruit there, and growing our free store is part of that.
The GoFundMe for the free stores needs a new roof can be found at gofundme.com/f/the-free-store-needs-a-new-roof. Currently, they have raised $4,870 from 37 different donations, but their goal is $6,000 in order to fund the installation and materials for the new roof.
They say don't count your chickens before they hatch, so it's a good thing that chickens aren't the fowl in mind in the North American Christmas bird count. Smithers community reporter Christine Bruce follows two people on their bird count adventure for this year's CBC.
Rosamond, you're our local compiler on behalf of Birds Canada. What does that involve?
Well, compiler is the person who actually ultimately, at the end of the count, takes in all the counts and literally compiles the data on a spreadsheet from each group, and that then gets added up to the totals, and then it gets entered into the Audubon data entry portal, and I have to also enter all kinds of things like number of people in a party, number of parties, weather conditions, the number of the people who were participants.
Websites like Birds Canada make a pretty big deal of the annual Christmas bird count data because it forms one of the world's largest sets of wildlife survey data and is used to assess population trends and bird distribution. How valuable can that be?
Oh, I think it's really valuable. We have to accept the fact that it's not completely scientific because it's not like a proper birding study where you have controls and things, but it does show trends over the years. It shows really good trends, and it's a really good guideline as to what the birds are doing in wintertime and whether there are changes being seen and things are declining or things are increasing or whatever. So it is very valuable.
Yeah. Have you noticed any worrying trends in the Smithers area?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Definitely seeing changes as a result of changing in climate. I mean, for example, I can remember years when we never got northern flickers. Now they're here all winter. There are certain species, like the finches, which are unpredictable. You've no idea what they're going to do. One year there'll be lots, and another year there won't be. And that's not really an indication of climatic changes or whatever. It's because of availability of food. But other species, like robins, varied thrushes, sparrows, that should really have migrated south, you'll get a few staying here if they've got a good food source. And we're now starting to see a few species like American goldfinch. We've only last 2 years had it on the bird count, and that it looks like it's moving into the territory now. That could be related to climate change. It could be just that they're expanding their territory. But there's definitely a relationship for some species with the climate. Others, it's just a cyclical thing. Sometimes, like, nuthatches have high years and low years. They're a resident, winter resident, but for some reason they go up and down in numbers.
Up next, my conversation with Frank McDonald. The two of us are standing at the entrance to the Barrett Hat Trail Network in snowshoes, ready for a brisk walk to see if we can spot any birds.
Frank, one of the reasons you and I were put in the same group this year was my request to be part of the group doing the fairgrounds where I live. But unfortunately, the day started out with a bit of a snowstorm, which discouraged the birds, and we ended up only seeing the lone bald eagle that likes to fish along the river. Were you disappointed with that?
No, I wasn't, because over the years, you don't know what you're going to find or where you're going to find it or when you're going to find it. So that was a good start, and we did see a number of other birds shortly after.
And I was really excited at how many we found at my feeder.
Well, I know in the past couple of years, at least we would stop in front of your trailer and look at the bird feeder. Certainly noted what birds we could see there.
I always feel like I'm not contributing to things, and then suddenly maybe I am. So I knew the feeder was attracting chickadees and juncos, but you added more specifics to both of those, and it's a great learning opportunity.
So when you say specifics,
the types of juncos and chickadees.
So typically in the lowland, you're going to find primarily black-capped chickadees, but there are four different species. Usually when you start getting a little bit of elevation, you get mountain chickadees as well, although they can be in the low ground. And then as you get higher in the mountains, you'll see the boreal chickadee. And occasionally, you'll find a chestnut-backed chickadee, which around Smithers have been found on the slopes of Hudson Bay Mountain, Glacier Gulch kind of area. I had one all winter at my feeder here 2 years ago. So the difference in their appearance, you know, the chickadees are about 5 to 5.5 inches, which would be like 13 to 15 centimeters. And the black caps, their name, black cap, and they have a black bib, white cheeks, basically gray overall on their wings, and kind of light white to buffy color underneath. Those are the ones that you hear saying chickadee-dee-dee, or springs here, or cheeseburger, or as one of my friends said, her grandchildren would point at each other and say, he did it, she did it.
These are great ways to remember what a bird says. That's fantastic.
Yeah. So, and if you can get kind of a mnemonic in your brain for what sounds a bird makes, and you quoted one to me when we were birding, is about the
poor Johnny Petey's pants.
Right.
Yeah, Rosamond taught me that one.
Right. And so that applies to quite a number of species, if it helps you remember the sound.
So there were a couple of species that you and your daughter were specifically looking for. I mean, we went to a couple of spots hoping to see a couple of things.
Mm-hmm. In past years, we've seen a few different species. A sharp-shinned hawk we've seen in the past, and that was we hoped for, but and there's every reason to expect we might have found it because they have been spotted around, possibly at Cooper's Hawk. But Steller's Jays, we had Steller's Jays, and there was a couple spots last year where we had the Northern Shrike, and we didn't spot any of those this year.
Well, you know, you're taking a chance every time you go out because you don't know what the weather's going to be like, how it's going to affect the birds.
Yeah, and just because you look at an almanac or a solitaire table and it says it's an activity period doesn't mean it's activity period where you are at that moment.
Yeah. I mean, they might be there an hour before or an hour after you leave, but they're not there at the moment you're there.
That's correct.
But it was still really wonderful to be able to go out and just watch the birds flying around. And we had some pretty big variation in mm-hmm. the species and...
Yeah, so some larger flocks, typically like the Bohemian waxwings, and they're targeting the ornamental fruit trees, crab apple trees, things like that, and you see them in large flocks. These flocks this year were actually smaller than last year. Last year we saw flocks of up to 1,000 birds, so we just haven't seen as many this year, but still nice. We did see one flock of over 30 crows in one.
Yes.
They were kind of like, almost like they were mobbing.
Rosamond Pojar is our most popular columnist in Smithers. Her weekly opinion contribution to the local newspaper, The Interior News, is called The Nature Nut. And if you want to get on the list for next year's bird count, you can contact Rosamond at rpojar, R-P-O-J-A-R, at gmail.com. If you're in the Houston area, I highly recommend a visit to the Barrett Hat Trail. To reach the trailhead, turn west off Highway 16 at Barrett Hat Road, near the top of Hungry Hill. You can park at the trailhead, located 1.3 kilometers from the highway. And at this time of year, it's best to take snowshoes. And finally, if you want to learn more about the national results from this and past year's annual bird count, visit any of the National Bird Organization websites, like birdscanada.org or the Audubon Society.
For the full episode on Christine Bruce's Christmas bird count, go to smithersradio.ca and click on CICK News Podcast. And speaking of longest running, the Rosalind Winter Carnival is Canada's longest running, which returned after a hiatus this year. Scott Onyeshuk from CJLY in Kootenay got out into the cold and wet to celebrate.
Canada's longest-running winter carnival, the Rosalind Winter Carnival, returned last weekend. Rain brought doubt to two of the most anticipated events, the bobsled races and the rail jam. But despite the weather, both events had large spectator turnouts and competitors had nothing but good things to say. Kootenay Co-op Radio was there speaking to contestants and attendees about their experience.
How did it feel to get the bobsled races back at the Rosalind Winter Carnival?
We know it was good to have it back. It's been a few years. Been doing it since I was in high school, so it was good to see it back.
The track was wet. It was a bit slow for everyone, but was it worth it that they brought it back?
200%.
This is my 15th year at the Rosalind Winter Carnival.
And it's wet, still a good turnout. What do you think of the event this year?
Yeah, the snow's soft, fast. Red Mountain did an awesome job building the course. Maybe one of the best they've had in a handful of years.
You said you're from Prince George?
Yeah.
So what brought you out to the Rosalind Winter Carnival?
I was just super stoked to hear that they're putting a rail jam in the middle of a street. It just seemed like a really cool concept. Fortunately, the rain is kind of bringing everyone down a bit, but not too much. Vibes are still high.
Still a good day skiing in the rain, though?
Oh, yeah. If you're skiing, it's a good day.
You know, just a huge sense of community. Growing up, the Winter Carnival was just everything you look forward to in the winter. And for the kids, like the rail jam and everything that goes on in the community. It's just, it's a cool presence of all the talents in the community and everything that comes together. And everybody here just showing off what they got. So, I mean, it's just, it's fun. It's so much fun being here, and that's it.
I'm from Chile, came here to ski. And Rosalind Winter Carnival is great, man. I'm having a good time. There's music.
Jamie, you ever been to the Rosalind Winter Carnival before?
First time, absolutely love it.
Where are you from?
Originally from Ontario, but just moved to Nelson. People are so welcoming, and I feel like I'm at home.
There were roughly 500 spectators gathered to watch the bobsled races on Saturday morning, and still over 200 at the rail jam in the afternoon, even though the rain picked up quite a bit. Reporting in Nelson, Scott Onyeshuk, KCR News.
On the topic of winter sports, Quesnel and Letako Dene First Nation are welcoming athletes to apply to the upcoming games happening February 22nd to the 25th. The games are an intentional way to foster space for Indigenous-led education and programming for all attendees. Here's CFER's Ian Gregg.
The Letako Quesnel 2024 BC Winter Games are coming to the region this February 22nd to 25th, of which the associated speed skating events will be held right here in Prince George, BC at the Outdoor Ice Oval. It's exciting to bring focus on competition and winter sport in our area. For the first time in its 46-year history, the BC Winter Games has been co-named by the host municipality of Quesnel and the local Indigenous community of the Letako Dene Nation. To that effect, Tim Mitchell, a Letako Dene Nation counselor, stated, quote, "For us, this is more than just a sporting event. All the participants gathering here in Quesnel will take home not only medals and memories of their competitions, but the stories and knowledge about our traditions and our people." Unquote. Brian Balkwill, president of the Quesnel Letako BC Winter Games, joins us today. Brian, the town site of Quesnel has seen the BC Winter Games before, back in 2000, and it went pretty well. What were some lessons learned from that experience?
Yeah, that's absolutely the case. Of course, being a multi-sport event of this nature, it's the biggest thing to come to Quesnel since the last time we held it in 2000. So There's a lot of learnings that they had from them. Of course, all the directors from that games are not a part of this games. So the learnings are coming fast and furious with our new group here, of course.
What are some of the challenges you're looking at this year? I'm sure the weather makes you a little nervous, but what's staring you in the face?
Well, the big thing, of course, is volunteers. And to pull off an event of this size, we need 1,300 volunteers. And we're very close to that now. We're over 1,100 as of today. And just a few more to go. And we're really looking for volunteers in the areas of accommodation, as well as food services and a few first aiders. Those are the key areas we're focusing on now.
So how many more people are you looking for? A couple hundred?
Yeah, probably a couple hundred, but it depends. It's a couple hundred shifts, and so it depends on the number of shifts that an individual sign up for. So if they all did two shifts, then we'd only need 100 more. So we're very close.
Some donations are rolling in. That helps a lot, obviously. Enbridge kicked in about $25,000 recently and a load of volunteers. Like you said, there's still room for more. What's the average business or the average person on the street thinking right now? Are they getting excited for the games? Can you feel the energy in the air?
Oh, you absolutely can. It's quite amazing. An event of this nature, of course, pulls the community together like no other event, I'm sure. Especially when you're going to have upward of 1,400 volunteers. Virtually anybody in the community is going to be involved in some way. The businesses are going to feel the impact of all the people coming to town when you throw the athletes as well as the parents and officials. We're going to have close to 3,000 people visit our community over that 4 days. So there'll be a great financial impact. And I know studies in the past have shown about $1.3 million financial impact to a community when we host an event like this. So we're pretty excited.
No doubt. Beyond recruiting volunteers, are there any challenges you're looking at as far as infrastructure, transportation, any event last changes you've had to overcome?
Well, I guess probably the biggest one is the one that we can't control, and that's snow. You know, we're thankful to get a dump of snow here just this past week, but that's been a biggest concern for us, but it's not something we're able to really control. So we do have 5 events that are on snow, both at Troll and Halas Lake. And right now they do have snow, so we're keeping our fingers crossed that we continue to get a little more.
Are you able to get a hold of any snowmaking equipment? Is that in the cards for some of the dynamic weather we're looking at?
So the Halas Lake Ski Club there, Caribou Ski Club, has a snowmaking setup that's pretty small in nature. So it's, you know, it's mainly around the stadium where the races will start and finish. So it'll help us to some degree. And I know Troll doesn't have any snowmaking equipment, but they do have options to move the race higher up the mountain where there's more snow. So, you know, we've done what we can, and we're just keeping our fingers crossed for those events. So that's one of the probably the biggest challenges that we don't have a lot of control over. And really the rest of the venues are all ready to go, and we're just tidying up with a few more volunteers so that we'll be ready for the games in less than 30 days.
It's coming up fast.
We're just excited to get on with it, and we just want to thank all the businesses, our sponsors, our provincial partners, and of course our volunteers for all the work they put in so far. Our board has been with us for close to 2 years, so it's been a lot of work, and we're just excited to be able to put on an event for our athletes in the province.
It looks like things are really moving well, and most important part is the human factor, and you've got that on your side.
Thanks for the time.
Brian Balkwill, president of the Quesnel Lhtako BC Winter Games. This is Ian Gregg reporting for CIFA Radio's Due North on 88.7 FM. This initiative is made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada through the Local Journalism Initiatives Program.
And that's this week's Scoop. Be sure to tune in again every Thursday at noon on 93.9 FM Smithers Community Radio. The Scoop is funded by the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Find The Scoop on smithersradio.com or wherever you get your podcasts.